1973 at Fairbanks, Alaska, for the Tano Yukon Historical Society. Our guest this evening is Frank Nash, a longtime Alaskan and highway engineer. The next voice you hear will be that of Mr. Nash.
Well, I was born in Indiana, up there as a youngster, and came to Seattle, Washington, where I attended elementary school and high school and college at what was then known as Seattle College, now known as Seattle University. I came to Alaska in 1914. It was rather a queer deal how I happened to leave Seattle and come to Alaska. We owned a house down in the south end of Seattle while we were living in the north end. The house in the south end of town was rented out. Something went haywire with it. My mother sent me down there to look at it. I went down, looked at it, and decided that what needed to be done, then went and visited a friend who lived close by. His mother met me and told me that I was going to lose my friend, that he was going to Alaska. I said, I have a notion to go with him. Why don't you? I made up my mind then and there to go. I went to a telephone, called my mother, and told her she would have to get somebody else to do that work. She says, where are you going? I says, to Alaska. When? Next Thursday. Okay, goodbye. Don't write home for money. Well, we came up on the old steamship Alameda to Seward in March of 1914. For 2 years, roamed around on in the Seward area, Kenai Peninsula. Then in 1916, went to work on the Seward division of the railroad, which was then the Alaska Engineering Commission. Worked on the reconstruction of the railroad there from Seward to Kern Creek during the years of 1916 to the fall of 1919. During that time, however, there was one break during which I put in a hitch in the Army during World War I. The spring of 1920, I came up to Fairbanks. Worked on the railroad here out of Fairbanks on the reconstruction of the old Tanana Valley Railroad, which was later abandoned, and then on the Alaska Railroad between Seward and Fairbanks. Between, I should have said, Nenana and Fairbanks. Stayed with the railroad off and on, and with the Alaska Road Commission off and on, between the years of 1920 and 1926. Then went to work for the Alaska Road Commission steady. 1928, I was appointed acting district superintendent. On January the 1st, 1929, I was appointed the superintendent for the Fairbanks District. We continued under the War Department until in the early 1930s when we were transferred to the Department of the Interior, at which time they changed the title of the head man of the division to district engineer. The principal work from 1930 on for a number of years was maintenance of the Richardson Highway and the local highway out as far as Chattanooga, we might say, and then later on the construction of the Steef Highway on over to Circle Hot Springs Road, later on the construction of the Livengood Road. And then later on, years after the War Department turned over the Alaska Highway to the Alaska Road Commission, we started the construction work on the Taylor Highway leading into Eagle. In 1950, I retired. At that time, we had constructed that road to Jack Wade Creek. It was later built on through to Eagle and Dawson. During the early days, though, of the construction before The days of the airplane, modern transportation, the Alaska Road Commission was charged with the maintenance of the winter trails over which the mail was hauled from Fairbanks to Circle, Kuskokwim areas, different areas by dog team. And that was a that was quite an experience. As the
tell us more about that. That's interesting.
Well, of course, all this mail was hauled absolutely by a dog team. There was absolutely no other means of travel, you might say, in those days. And it was a case then of going out in the middle of the winter and building these bridges across some of the streams that they couldn't get across otherwise on account of the depth of them, even though they were dry and frozen, that your dog sleds were just simply too long to get across them.
Did you build shelters?
You'd have to put shelters, and we all put bridges in those places. And we also built shelters, cabins throughout the country on these trails at an average distance of 18 to 20 miles between them, which were also used at time by trappers. I'd forgot that part.
Yeah, that's an interesting
deal. Yeah.
How about building docks for the steamships and so forth? Do you have any?
Not in this district. We didn't have any of that boat deal. See, the district here went south as far as, we didn't go to McKinley Park, just north of McKinley Park a little ways, and then out the Richardson Highway as far as Black Rapids. Mm-hmm. And then later on, of course, when the Alcan was built, they stretched the territory clear up to the Canadian boundary, taking in Eagle and all those points.
Let me ask you a few questions. The first question is, you were born in Indiana, but you didn't stay what year?
1893, December the 22nd.
1893. And you went to Seattle, and you left Seattle, and you went to Seward, and you had odd jobs, I take it, in the Seward Peninsula mm-hmm. during that particular period of years.
Yeah.
And eventually you went from a laborer, I guess you'd say, odd jobs to engineering on the old Alaska Railroad.
Right.
And you graduated from the Alaska Railroad as an engineer into the as an engineer with the old Alaska Road Commission.
Right.
Or its predecessor.
Yep. Yep.
Now you've been involved in the maintenance of the Richardson Highway, the building of the Steese Highway, the building of the Elliott Highway, the building of the Taylor Highway, and the Alaska Highway.
And no, not on the Alaska Highway. That was all done by the Army.
Oh, that was an Army deal.
Yes.
Well, there are several questions that thoughts that enter my mind. Now, when you took over as the engineer in 1929, the district engineer for the Fairbanks District, how many people did you employ at that time?
During the summer months, there would be around, at the very most, 250.
250.
And that would only last during the last half of May, June, July, August, and first half of September.
And the maintenance equipment at that particular time, I imagine you had horses.
The majority, up until about 1935, the majority of the work was done by horsepower.
And did the state, or did you take care of the horses, or did they belong to the
no,
government?
They
or
were, they, no, they were hired from individuals.
Yeah.
Another would probably be one or two men like Ed mm-hmm. Bull, Ed Bartlett,
mm-hmm.
and Harry Warren. They were old-time teamsters
yeah.
here that had maybe two or four teams, and we'd
yeah.
hire
mm-hmm.
them to do the work.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you had a work crew out on the road, I know that years ago there used to be lots of tent frames where you lived out in tents. That was a standard.
They were all tent camps.
And if it was a permanent camp, you had a wooden tent frame.
The permanent camps were few and far between.
Yeah.
In fact, we had no permanent camps until the very late 40s.
Yeah. Well, you had the had horses, and that was in the early 30s, and then you graduated to tractors.
Tractors, dozers.
And
pull graders. Pulled by a tractor.
Yeah.
And then later on, the motor grader that mm-hmm. they're using now.
Now, Your earliest tractors were small and you had the pull grader?
The earliest tractors were the old Alice Chalmers Model K. The horsepower, I don't remember what they were, but they were pretty small.
No, and then you had a larger model?
Then later on, of course, they came in with the larger
ones. The L model.
And finally, when I left in 1950, the largest one was, I believe, an Alice Chalmers TD20.
Mm-hmm. Now the trucks, you used horses and wagons until about what year when you got motorized
trucks? Well, until the Model T Ford put out their first dump trucks.
I see. That would have been in the 20s sometime, I presume.
That was in the late 20s.
Late 20s, you had Model T.
Yeah.
And what trucks did you have after the Model T?
Well, we never did go over, as I remembered now, what they called the Model A Ford dump truck, and they'd hold about 2 yards.
Yeah.
About the largest we ever had.
Yeah. Now, were there any peculiar problems with the maintenance of the Richardson Highway, as an example?
Well, there were several of them. The biggest stumbling block was the permafrost.
Oh,
that was the hardest one to solve.
Hasn't been solved yet.
It really hasn't been solved yet.
I think, really, when you look at that permafrost solving, maybe that you people in your age did as much as anyone, because on the Steese Highway, you can still see the corduroy, and that's a pretty good road where you buried the timber.
That's it. The secret of the whole darn thing was to lay your corduroy or your fill or whatever you were going to do on top of all the moss. Mm. Don't break that seal on top.
Yeah.
Try to keep that intact.
Yeah.
Because the minute you broke that, you let the air, the heat, and one thing or another get in there and work on that ice underneath your moss, and that just wrecked it. As it thawed, the road would naturally settle and heave, and one thing or another, and when it had freezing in winter, it'd heave.
Yeah. I've often marveled at that road going to the Steese Highway, because there are places where you can see the corduroy, and the road is good.
Sure, the road would be lower than the ends. The ends of the corduroy would be kind of sticking up and be rounded off.
Now, one of the things in the Fairbanks area, of course, you've got the permafrost, and I'm sure that you were here when they built the dike. Now, most people in Fairbanks do not realize that Fairbanks is on an island. Mm-hmm. And it was on an island until they built the dike over here at
Moose Creek.
At Moose Creek. Mm-hmm. And I imagine that you were here at that particular time, possibly the engineer on that project.
That was built by the Army engineers.
Oh, I see.
And, of course, the main object was to cut off the overflow water that came down a slough that branched off of the Tanano River at mile 28 of what we called Old Pile Driver.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the main source of the water that really came down through Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
What little water came down the Chena River at that time wasn't much of a bother.
Mm-hmm.
They built that dike to shear off that overflow from the Tanano, which would just leave the clear Chena water coming through Fairbanks.
Do you remember how much it lowered the Chena River when they put that dike in?
No, I don't. I don't remember. I don't think it didn't seem to lower it too much in the average time, but you could notice the difference during the breakup. Spring of the year, that's when you could notice the difference.
Now, that was in, about 1935 or in the middle 30s?
That was in the early 40s.
Early 40s when they put that in.
As near as I can recall.
Now, do you remember what equipment they used on that?
A contract job, I didn't pay much attention to it.
That's all mechanized anyway, horses at that time.
No, not at all.
Now, the mail trail to Valdez, of course, operated, I guess the road opened in about 1920 to Valdez, first car, I believe.
Well, they went over it before that. Bobby Sheldon took his first car over there. I don't remember just when it was.
Yeah, it was prior to 1920.
It might have been in the very early 20s. Mm-hmm. I really don't recall.
Mm-hmm. Now, and then of course you had the mail, of course, went down. There are many roadhouses that no longer exist, and a telegraph line connected each one.
Yeah, they're all, you might say they're all gone now.
And you maintain that you must have had dog teams too, if you were going to maintain the trail.
We did. We absolutely had dog teams. We had as many as 50, 60 dogs here at one time.
Is that a fact?
And talking about that reminds me that now, today, in Seattle, you go to buy smoked salmon.
Yeah.
You'll pay as much as $3.5 to $4 a pound for it. Many's a ton of smoked salmon I bought down here at Ruby.
Mm-hmm.
2 cents a pound.
To feed the dogs.
Used for dog feed.
And were the dogs that belong to the government, or they?
Oh yes, they were all owned by the government. Oh. The dogs that we had were originally used by the old Signal Corps.
Oh, I see.
The old Wombcats who maintained the telegraph line from Valdez into Eagle, and then from Eagle down to Yukon, all the way to Nome.
Hmm.
And over into different places too, over into McGrath on the Kuskokwim and other places.
Well, you would have had, I guess, the Kuskokwim run down to McGrath, and the one to Tanana, one to Circle, and then one down to Valdez, and I imagine there were other trails that you maintained.
Oh yes, there was quite a few others. There was one time a winter trail going from Fairbanks into Chandelier, the Yukon River at Beaver.
Yeah, that trail is still visible, and the shelter cabin.
Uh-huh, and there was also, of course, a mail trail from clear down to Yukon.
Yeah.
Dawson to
mm-hmm.
Eagle.
Yeah.
Of course, that was done on a cooperative basis with the Canadian government.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, there was one come on down the river all the way down. I don't know if there was any between Fort Yukon and Rampart. But I do know that they went then from, I think the Rampart mail went in from Hot Springs, from Manly Hot Springs.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
And then they went on from Ruby on down, clear on down to Nome.
Now, the airplane, I think, started hauling mail in about 1935 or that general area. I think I also took the mail down to McGrath.
Time, yeah.
And I imagine you got rid of the dogs then sometime.
Yeah, as soon as they started in, well, we began to cut down on that.
And I imagine, did you have dogs in 1940? Did you still have any dogs then?
We probably had a few, but very few.
Yeah. Well, I didn't care. Now, that's an interesting
mm-hmm.
thing that very few people realize, that the road mm-hmm. commission had dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when they built the road out to Circle, and that road's still not maintained all year round, you know. It's
still closed in the winter.
Still closed in the winter.
Yeah.
And, of course, that Circle Road north of Eagle Summit, I don't know of any place that's got more problems with permafrost than that. That's the grandfather of permafrost country,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
God.
It is.
When they built the highway from here, they more or less went along with the Tano Valley Railroad, didn't they? They more or less paralleled it out to Fox, I guess.
No, you see, the railroad went from here down to Goldstream, then up Goldstream to Gilmore, then swung around, went up over Stafford Summit, and down.
Was that Dome to Alma's? No.
Not Bone Creek, the creek on the other side.
Chattanooga.
Nope.
Yeah, I don't know what it is.
I can't remember the name of that creek on the other side there that goes down there into Olness, and then on down to, well, at Olness they hit the, at Olness you hit the Chattanooga River.
Mm-hmm.
But going from the top of the hill down to Olness.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what the name of that creek was just now. But anyhow, it's the one next to, mm-hmm. next to Dome Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And then the highway, though, when it went over, the mm-hmm. Livengood Road, when it went over, we stayed on the other side and went down Dome Creek.
I see. Now, going up Cleary Summit, and that road was built in the late 20s, wasn't it?
And going to Cleary Summit, that was built... Yeah, it was built in the late 20s.
Late 20s. Now that's quite a grade even today, going up that hill, and that I imagine would have been done with your first tractors you got in this country.
No, that was done before we had any tractors.
That road
was built before we had any tractors whatsoever.
That was built with horsepower.
Yeah. That, I think there's some of that must be at least 12% grade going up there for a ways from Scoogee Gulch on up.
Yeah, even today it's more than a standard grade, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't realize that. How far out did they build? Did they build that whole road with horsepower all the way to Circle?
No, they built up to about the Long Creek and up in there before they converted it over. But of course, in the earlier days, the road was built from Circle out to Miller House.
Yes.
That was all horse. And then we come along later on and reconstructed it, but we had tractors and dozers in.
Then they used mechanical equipment from about Long Creek to Miller House.
Yeah.
I see. Well, that's interesting. Did, let's see now, I guess, did the Davidson Ditch go in before the road, or did the road go in and then the Davidson Ditch?
Well, it went, some of it went in about the same time.
I see.
Just about the same time. Mm-hmm. We were working on the road and the ditch, you might say, at the same time.
I see.
Yep.
And
I forgot all about that ditch.
Yeah, well, the ditch, of course, you know, was ruined in the 67 flood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, on the other side of the river, you had the walk, the summer, the winter trail.
Mm-hmm.
Now, surely in your many years up here, you were out in the field a lot. You must have spent some time and known some interesting roadhouse keepers. I'm thinking of the roadhouse that used to be right up from Chattanooga now.
Well, up at Chattanooga there was Walter Preston, the colored man, who was there for a number of years. Then there was Guy and Nell Birch, who were there until... I don't remember just when they were there, and I don't recall now who went in there after they were there.
I don't know.
Oh, and there was also in the earlier days before the Birches took over, there was Clyde Airy and the fellow named Whitey Kennedy there.
Mm-hmm.
Then on up the line at Faith Creek, there was Bob Simpson and old Jack Bolton. At 12 Mile, Mr. and Mrs. Park Reed. At Miller House, Frank Miller and his wife, Graziella.
Oh, yeah. They were good friends of mine.
Yep. And then over at Central, it was Stead. I think his first name was Henry. And Riley Erickson.
Yeah, Riley.
And then, of course, over at Hot Springs, there was Frank Leach.
Yeah. Now, you're speaking about that time frame would be about in the 30s, right?
Yes.
Now, the Millers used to operate a roadhouse just beyond Long Creek, and it's on the south side of the Chattanooga River, and the roadhouse has a Spanish name.
Cassiar.
Cassiar.
Right. Right. I can't remember the name of the man that operated that when I first went up there.
That roadhouse burned, as you know.
Well, it's been gone for years, yes.
Yeah, I understand someone set it on fire.
Probably. Seems like that's a habit that they have it doing with a lot of the old cabins around here for some reason or
other. Back near the Cassiar Roadhouse, there is a pretty large stand of blue spruce. And I'm wondering if somebody didn't bring in some blue spruce and plant it at that roadhouse and it spread. It's the only place in interior of Alaska that I've ever seen or heard of blue spruce.
They must have, because you say that's the only place there is any of it around the country that I know of.
Yeah, I thought possibly you might know of some legend where someone brought it in.
No, I never heard anything about that. I've noticed that blue spruce there, but I've never heard any... anyone say anything about how come it is there?
Yeah, it's the only blue spruce that I'm aware of.
That's the only one I know of.
Now, when you built the Livengood Road, I guess that was built to supply the mines, and that was built in about the same time as the Steese Highway, was it?
No, it was built later on. The Steese Highway was all completed by the time we started work on the Livengood Road, Elliott Highway.
Yeah, the Elliott must have been built then in the 30s.
Well, let's see. Yes, it was built in the 30s, all right. Yeah.
And that would have been done with
that
machines.
Was all done with modern equipment.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. When you're building these particular roads in those days, the engineering, I guess it was all done locally?
The engineering on those jobs was all locally, yes. Oh. Holly Sterling, who was a former district engineer here, and later on the assistant chief engineer of the road commission, laid out the present Livengood Road.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, now there have been a few minor line changes
yeah.
made, and there will probably be
yeah.
more in the future.
The old day of the side hill cut is gone.
I don't know, just...
You know, the side hill cuts going around and...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and that, yeah. I think that form of road construction
mm-hmm.
is gone.
Yeah, well, that's out now. Of course, that was followed more on account of just following the contour grade around.
Yeah. Well, you didn't have the equipment to move the dirt. You
that's
had no
right.
choice.
You didn't have the equipment to move the dirt, so you couldn't make these shortcuts,
mm-hmm.
these modern shortcuts,
yeah.
and make a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
You can move dirt so much quicker and cheaper now that it's really cheaper to go straight sometimes than it is
yeah.
to follow the contour
mm-hmm.
grade.
And I imagine you had your own bridge engineers and built all the bridges in those days from local material, or nearly all of them.
Well, some of them, many of them that run in over 100-foot span or something of that kind of size, why, they were built with timber from the outside. They
I
were
see.
More spruce and... I can't remember now just what it was. But it was all timber anyhow,
mm-hmm.
purchased from the state of
mm-hmm.
Washington, Douglas fir.
Oh yeah,
Douglas
mm-hmm.
fir.
I
stuff.
See.
But anything smaller than that, most of the time was built out of native timber.
I see.
And they would last in the neighborhood of about 15 years.
Mm-hmm. There were a few isolated steel bridges, but not very many.
The only steel bridge was the one here across the Chena Slough here in Fairbanks, which was erected in 1916. Was dismantled in the 30s and moved to Nome.
Mm-hmm.
I forget this, just the location where it was used
mm-hmm.
in Nome.
Mm-hmm.
There was another steel bridge then later on put in across Noy Slough, which I believe is now out on the crossing in the Little Chena, on the Chena Hot Springs Road.
Oh, yeah.
That's the only, and that's the only one I can remember of in the early days.
There's, I think, Washington Creek on the
Livengood Road?
Livengood Road has a, is it Washington Creek? There's one of those creeks that had a steel bridge. Heck, it may have been the Chattanooga. I think it was the Chattanooga had a narrow...
The Chattanooga, I know the original build bridge there was a... was just a timber bridge.
Timber
at least I think according to my memory.
Yeah.
But I might be wrong on that,
yeah.
though.
Now, the road from Livengood to Manly, was that put in...
No, that's foreign to me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know a thing about that. I put in after I left.
What size community did we have at Livengood at the time that road was put in?
The time that road was put in, I'd say there was probably around 300 people over there.
300 people.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember some of the prominent people there? I guess the Millers had a, Mrs. Miller had a restaurant over there.
At one time, yes. Well, there was old Ben Pauls, who was over there yet, I understand.
Oh.
Nick Mandich and his partner, and oh, there would, gosh, the Hudsons were all over there, Blanche Cascaden, and there were several on Olive Creek, Amy, Gertrude, some on Livengood Creek, some of them on over there that were working for the company that took over there. I don't remember the name of the company now.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie Lewis was in charge of it.
I guess that World War II is probably the thing that signaled the end of some of those little, the
it
end
was,
of gold
absolutely,
mining.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
You know, that's signaled the end of quite a few of the small towns in
yeah.
the country.
Have you got that off?
No. Well, we'll just run the tape out here. We just have a few more seconds, and then we'll turn it over. Good. Can you tell us anything about the school at Live and Good in the 30s?
No, I don't believe there was any there then. There might have been, but I don't remember.
You didn't have to take care of the schools?
No, we had nothing absolutely to do with any of the schools.
We'll jump over here to Big Delta. And one thing we forgot to discuss were was the ferry. Now, there was a ferry over there at Big Delta.
Yes, there was a ferry there that it operated under its own power, mm-hmm. the current of the river, carrying the boat across mm-hmm. the river, which was used from the inception of the trail, which was in 1903, until long when the army came in, and the first bridge they put in across there was a pile trestle, which was at the location of the roadhouse that was operated by Rico Wallen. But just shortly after they put that in, we started the construction of a permanent bridge across the river just about 1,000 feet downstream mm-hmm. from there, and that was the first bridge across the Tanana in that area that mm-hmm. stayed for any length of time.
Mm-hmm.
It was since then been replaced by a larger bridge by the Bureau of Public Roads.
Yeah, I think they put a steel bridge in, and yes. then another. The steel bridge has since been replaced by another.
That's right. Yeah.
Down in that Big Delta area, we've got the Wallen's place. Was that called, that wasn't called Big Delta, was it?
Where that place has been called by three different names that I know of. First was Grundler, and then McCarty, and then Big Delta.
Big Delta.
Now the Grundler, I don't know just where that name came from.
Mm-hmm.
McCarty came from the name of Dan McCarty and his son who operated the roadhouse there mm-hmm. for a number of years. And then somebody else, I don't remember who it was, took it over, and then Rico Wallen finally took it over and operated it from the early 20s until her death, I guess.
Yeah, just several years ago.
Yes.
Are you familiar with a place called Washburn? Wasn't there a Washburn along
Washburn,
the highway?
Washburn, that was over farther on the south end, someplace between Rapids and Valdez, which I had no connection whatsoever.
Oh, I see.
Seems as near as I recall, it was over closer to Valdez
mm-hmm.
than Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
I might be mistaken about that, too. It might have been up on the Delta River someplace up there, but I'm not sure.
I'm not positive it either, but I've heard of Washburn somewhere mm-hmm. along the highway.
That's right.
Well, what did you do about protecting the road when the glacier down there at Rapids started racing.
We didn't do anything. There wasn't anything you could do. We just held our breath, hoping that it didn't come on across the river.
Yeah. I guess it advanced quite rapidly and for some length of time.
It did. It advanced quite rapidly for several weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that road has had plenty of problems with washouts, and I guess you've had plenty of glaciation and so forth.
Especially that area from Jarvis Creek on south there.
Yeah.
One time, I'd been out there and I'd went south of Jarvis Creek. I don't remember just where I went, but anyhow, when I went over, I could see the creek was coming up pretty fast. I came back and I just got across the creek about 100 yards farther down the road and I heard a kaboom. I turned around and went back and there was no bridge there. I came on in to Fairbanks and I wired Bob Shepherd, who was then the superintendent of Chipton. Told him that the Jarvis Creek Bridge would out and wouldn't be replaced until the water subsided and one thing and another. He wired back, don't worry about Jarvis Creek. Every bridge between Gunny Sack Creek and Valdez, out! The reason that all that happening that way down there is that mountain chain there, just behind there, just up high there, and these streams all stand on end.
Mm-hmm.
And when the rains cut loose up there, they cut loose. And that water comes down there in just a wall.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll move boulders down there the size of a car like nobody's mm-hmm. business. And you never see them. They hit clear down into the river there.
Mm-hmm.
And they can raise merry hell in no time at all.
Mm-hmm. I imagine in those days that the Road Commission played a big role in rescuing people. They were probably the only public agency around here that had transportation. Well, and dogs as an example, and horses.
That's right. Of course, in the summertime, when anything like that happened, well, it was entirely up to the Road Commission to get them out of there, which they usually did. We only had, as I recall it, during my time, we only had one or two fatalities before anybody lost their lives in there. And that was a place called Miller Creek.
Mm-hmm.
I lost a couple in there, and those are the only two that I can recall.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you observe in road construction today have good camps or trailer camps. They've got, I presume, everything from air conditioning to TV.
Right.
And I'm reminded in my younger days I'd see these road commission camps. For instance, out there on the Taylor Highway. In fact, it still may be true in the Taylor Highway. But saving perishables. Now, this obviously gets a little bit away from engineering, but being you the superintendent, I'm sure that you were involved in providing fresh meat and food for these people at camps 100 or 200 miles from Fairbanks in the summertime. And they always seemed to have it.
They always seemed to have it. Well, we'd get it out to them as often as we could. And then it was up to them to do their best to protect it while they had it and make it last as long as they could. They'd have to get it out, and if they could find some place in a shaft where this permafrost was, where they could store it. You know, there were places where they had what you'd call maybe a well down, and they'd let the meat down on a windlass down in those places and keep it. Other places where they didn't have that is just a case of hanging up in a tree where the air circulated good and let it form a crust on it and keep it just as long as they could.
Yeah, I think they did pretty good. I've seen many places where they had a screened buildings.
They would build a small screen cache and keep it in that.
Mm-hmm.
But the main object, main thing there was to keep it, to keep the air circulating around it.
Yeah.
I thought another interesting thing about these road camps was the fact that no one ever went hungry. If any stranger come along, he got a meal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we didn't make it a practice of feeding the public, but when they come along and we're up against it, well, we generally took care of them. But the majority of them always paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, but if some of these old-timers that were up against it and didn't have anything, why, we didn't holler too much about it.
Mm-hmm. Jumping back just a little bit, you're talking about working for the railroad. You got back to Alaska in about 1920, and you worked here in the Fairbanks District for the railroad, and the Tanana Valley Railroad was still running.
The Tanana Valley Railroad was still running in 1920, and it continued operating for about another year or possibly two after that before it was completely abandoned.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine that was abandoned because your highway probably.
The highway, that was one reason of building the first 20 miles of the what is now the Livengood Road.
Yes. Uh-huh.
See, we built down to Olness.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, they had built the Steese Highway to Chattanooga, which took care of those two points, which were the two main points on the Tanana Valley Railroad out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there really wasn't very much mining. After El Dorado closed, I guess there was no one between Olmos and Chattanooga.
That's right. No one in between there. Mm-hmm. The mining then was, after that, then the mining was practically all down at Chattanooga.
Mm-hmm. Well, Cleary must have been a pretty good-sized town when you first started working on the roads in that area.
Cleary at that time was a pretty good-sized town. There was probably 100 people there.
That would be in the 30s.
Yeah, in the early 30s.
And I guess at the World War II, that was the end of.
That was the end of Cleary, and that was the end of Dome.
I see. Dome had people in the 30s.
Oh, yes. Dome had a few in the 30s.
I see.
But it was in the very early 30s. By the late 30s, Dome was a thing of the past.
I see. Well, how about Gilmore?
Well, there was Gilmore. It folded up completely right after the railroad was abandoned.
I see. And Fox?
Fox was outside of Max Reedy. It was gone in the early 30s.
Oh, I see.
It was gone earlier.
Oh, I see. Now, there used to be a roadhouse out there. What was the name of that roadhouse? It had something to do with Half Moon. It wasn't Half Moon. Wasn't there a roadhouse out between here and Fox?
Not that I recall.
Oh, I see. I thought there was one out there.
No, not that I recall.
You haven't asked him anything about his cooks.
About what?
The cooks you've had some interesting cooks.
Well, you know that we've never talked about cooks, that's right. And you must have had problems getting cooks and getting them out there in the field stations, and they must have attracted bears at every location you had a camp.
Well, of course, in the early days on the construction, it was practically all men cooks.
Yeah.
Some of them were very good, some were indifferent, and some were bad.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a problem no matter where you were. You had nothing modern or anything of the kind. Sometimes they even had to perform in a pair of hip boots.
Mm-hmm.
Things were just that wet and damp and one thing or another. Then, of course, when we went on to maintenance and could have a more or less permanent camp, well, then the women came into the picture, and we had the women cooks.
What about the time that... I don't want to comment.
Go ahead.
Tell me about the time that they got rid of the cook with the bears.
Got rid of what?
The cook with the bear. You know, John was telling about it. They had one cook, and they didn't like him. And
no,
so they
fixed
it so that the bear would scratch against the cook tent.
I couldn't hear.
Woke him up.
I couldn't hear half of what John was saying.
Oh, you didn't?
That, no. Mm-hmm. Or yesterday.
Well, they had this cook out there on one of the, I don't know whether it was on a maintenance or whether it was on construction, and they didn't like him. He was just not acceptable to the men. So they fixed it with something so that the bear would scratch up against the tent at night, and that scared him away, and he left, and they got another cook.
Mm-hmm. Well, that could have been all right.
Well, I'd imagine the cooks that you had prior to 1932, about half of them should have been able to make moonshine.
Some of them did.
I imagine they did.
Some of them did. Oh, every once in a while you'd catch one with a brew of some kind of going.
Yeah, and I imagine they used a lot of vanilla. Those were the days when vanilla had alcohol in it.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's how I'm dead. But we had some darn good cooks in those days, too. You'd surprise the quality of the food that they would put out.
And bakers, good
and
bakers.
And bakers, too, very good.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, they were very good. Well, there was one character up there on Faith Creek that... I mentioned a while ago, I think I mentioned his name, Jack Bolton.
Yeah.
He had, in his earlier days, he had been a sailor in the English Navy. He was always talking about Holy Stone on the deck down. Long in the Prohibition days, old Jack, he used to have a tap out in about every other tree around the roadhouse there at Faith Creek. Somebody come along that he knew, he'd say, "Hey, do you want a drink?" "Oh yeah, I'll take one." Well, he said, "Wait a minute, I'll have to go out and tap a tree." So he'd go out, and pretty soon he'd come in with a little flask, a little white mule in it. He'd done that for years. But he liked it himself pretty well. Many's the time that I went in there, and that man would look at me, and then he'd look around the house and tell me to look out. "If you don't look out, that green fellow up there will get you." But despite all of that, I never seen a cleaner place in my life.
Mm-hmm.
He really had that floor holy stone until it just shined.
Yeah.
His table and everything else was just as clean as could be.
That's on Faith Creek.
That is on Faith Creek.
What was your worst cook?
What was the worst one? Well, the worst one I really recall was one that we had when Donald McDonald, Ivor Quinlow, a man named Scott Reese, packer was Jim Gibson, and Ivor and I were on the survey of the Steis Highway. We had an old fellow that called Jimmy the Goat that was a cook. He just didn't give a darn about anything, and he couldn't cook at all. Finally, one day, he up and quit. Boy, did we thank the Lord that he quit, even if we didn't have a cook.
Mm-hmm.
He was about the worst one I ever run across.
What'd you do as a result?
What did we do as a result? Well, tell you the truth, I done the cooking for the rest of the summer.
But it's three men or four men you surveyed that route?
On the most of the survey of the Steis Highway, from Chattanooga, clear on over to Circle, consisted of myself, Donald McDonald, Ivor Quinlow, and Scott Reese.
That would have been about 27?
Well, that was from 25 to 28.
Oh, mm-hmm. Well, you packed, used horses?
Horses. Absolutely.
And you camped. You just kept on moving your camp.
You just kept moving a few miles ahead at a time.
Hmm.
Just depended on the weather conditions and places where we could get water and one thing another.
How'd you get your supplies?
They were brought out from Fairbanks by... They'd get to Chattanooga somewhere or other, and then we'd pack them out from there on a horse.
I imagine the bean played a big role in your diet on there.
That's
and
right.
Rice and
yep.
Dried fruit.
The bean, the grayling, and the caribou.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Alaska, I remember when I first got up here, you possibly know the guy by the name of Nelson, O.A. Nelson. It used to be at Chittenden.
O.A. Nelson, it used to be at Chittenden, yes.
You know, and I remember I'd known him for several years. I used to go over there every summer for a few days. And one day he said to me, he said, what is your real name? He says, I know the name that you go by in Alaska. He said, but what's your real name? Well, I understand in the 30s and so forth, there were no end of people that had escaped the States for one reason or another and were using assumed names. And I imagine that you hired your share of people that were later picked up by the law and whatnot for various reasons?
Well, I really don't recall of any of them that were picked up by the law, but I recall of several of them that probably should have been.
Yeah.
But they weren't. No, I really don't recall of any of them. But they do say that in the early days there were several men came up from the States and came up to Alaska here that were just one jump ahead of the sheriff for some reason or other. They got up here and they took they didn't take really assumed names, they just took a nickname and went with that. Anybody, of course, nobody questioned the other guy in those days.
Yeah.
We didn't give a darn what he done. As long as he treated you right, well, that is fine. We didn't care what he done. We didn't inquire about him.
Frank, did you know Two-Step Louie?
Two-Step Louie?
Yeah.
Yes, I did. He was a brother of Blanche Cascadens.
Oh, he was?
Yep.
Well, a Two-Step Louie, wasn't he at the Pioneer home? In fact, he might still be there.
No, I don't think so.
No,
I think he died a few years ago.
Well, there's a guy at the Pioneer home that danced till heck won't have it. He was a great dancer.
But there is a grave in the wagon out at Esther. At Esther. Mm-hmm. And it says this is the grave. Inside that wagon, it says this is the grave of Two-Step Louie.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
have there been more than one Two-Step Louies?
No,
not that I know of. It was just the one.
I'm sure that in your tours, you must have run across a guy by the name of Sam White and his.
Sam White lives here in Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
Sam was one of the first guys you might say that I knew around Fairbanks. I knew Sam when he first came in here with the Geological Survey.
Well, that's how he came up here with the and he had horses.
That's right.
He worked with horses.
Yeah, that's right. They used pack horses to get around here to get up on these mountain tops and survey.
You met him
these
then. You met
things.
Him down on the toward Anchorage somewhere.
Down toward Anchorage, down in there someplace. Yeah. I don't remember just where. And then afterwards, seen him up here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you say you were at the, on the Alaska Railroad in the around 1925, 26?
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, they were cutting ties along Turnagain Arm. There were some lumber camps in there.
I was up here then, and I didn't know what was going on down around there, but there undoubtedly was, because they were cutting ties up in this area at the same time.
Well, I suppose when you first started on this as an engineer, that the road commission probably had hunters.
No, we never employed a hunter to get wild game or fresh meat. There was always somebody in the camp able to go out and...
I see.
Any time when it was permissible.
That was when an animal was available, probably.
That's right. That generally was.
At that time, yeah.
At that time, yes.
Yeah. What was the question? Well, let's just take a pause here for a short time. All over, and you tell us about Nellie Neal Lawing.
Nellie Neal Lawing, I first knew her out of Seward in 1916. That time she was operating a roadhouse at a station on the Alaska Railroad at mile 45, was called Grand View. Then later on, after the railroad was completed on through and up north, she went up to what was then called Dead Horse, now Curry, and operated the roadhouse there for a few years. Then after that, she returned back to the Seward area and operated a roadhouse and a tourist attraction at mile 23, which was later called Lloyd, on the Alaska Railroad on Lake Kenai.
Mm-hmm. Did she hauled mail, didn't she? U.S. mail by dogs at one time?
Not that I know of.
Mm-hmm. But she was an interesting person. I saw her, I guess, just a few months before she passed away.